Someone has said we live in a day of casual Christianity. It has been said that if the average church today were to drop 1/4 of the members from its membership roll, perhaps neither the church nor the dropped members would know any different. I hope that isn't true. And if it is, I'm embarrassed by the fact that it would be true. And I'm sure it is with some churches. Casual Christians could be defined as those who want to be numbered with the flock but couldn't care less about following the shepherd. They want the forgiveness that the cross of Christ brings, but they have no intention whatsoever of ever carrying their own cross. They want warm and fuzzy Sunday mornings, but they want nothing to do with commitment to Jesus on Monday. To sum it all up, I suppose you could say they want the crown, but not the cross. In Matthew chapter 16, verse 24, Jesus gives us the basics of true discipleship. He said, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." I believe there are three basic principles that are contained in that verse that must live in our hearts if you and I are going to truly be disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. Jesus sets it forth very clearly. First of all, number one, we've got to lay something down. He said, "If anyone will come after me, let him deny himself." What does that mean? A lot of people have the idea that this self-denial that Jesus is referring to here is kind of like what we were talking about in Sunday school class this morning on the subject of fasting, where we deny ourselves certain food for a period of time. Or maybe we deny ourselves certain privileges or certain things like the television. It comes as a surprise to some people that that's not really what the Lord is talking about here. Those things are important in their proper place and in the proper perspective, things that we must cease doing in order to be successful servants of the Lord are very important things, and we dare not be sidetracked away from identifying those things and taking the proper action toward those things that hinder us from serving the Lord have to be put away. No doubt about it, but that's not what Jesus is saying here. The word deny, in connection with deny himself, is a word which literally means to completely disown or to utterly separate one's self from someone. In order to understand that a little better, I can assure you that it is the exact same word that was used in Matthew chapter 26 to describe what Peter did when he said vehemently, and then finally with cursing, "I do not know that man." Peter was utterly and completely disassociating himself with Jesus Christ when he denied Jesus. It is the same exact terminology that Jesus uses here when he says we have got to utterly and completely disown, separate ourselves from self. When we do that, it must be in conjunction with dedicating and committing ourselves to someone else in that place. And Jesus says the next thing is taking something up. It is to Him that we completely and utterly commit ourselves. After having completely disassociated ourselves with self and selfishness, we dedicate ourselves to Jesus. And He says we must take up our cross. Now, there's a little bit of misunderstanding on the part of some people as to what that cross is. I've heard people say, "Boy, I just live with the awfulest old woman. She's the naggingest wife I ever had, ever saw, there ever could be on this earth. But I guess, you know, she's just my cross to bear." Or I've heard people say, "That neighbor of mine across the back fence, he's the most disagreeable fellow I ever saw in my life. I can't get along with him in any way, shape, matter, or form. You know, I really ought to move, but I keep hoping he'll move first. I guess he's just my cross to bear." I've heard people speak of an illness, a chronic problem that they may have. It seems the doctors have no way to find a cure for it. And maybe they've been told this is just something you're going to have to live with, something you just have to deal with the rest of your life. And I've heard them put it in these terms: "You know, I guess that's just my cross to bear." Folks, that's not what Jesus is saying. He's not talking about your disagreeable wife. He's not talking about your mean neighbor. He's not talking about your chronic ailments. You see, the cross was not just a portion of suffering. The cross was an instrument of death. Death on a cross was final. There was no turning back from it. There was no straying away from it. When one took up his cross, as Jesus would do after having made this statement, there was no turning away. There was no relief. There was no relief granted. There was no source of relief. When one took up the cross, the end of the road was death. No backing out. No changing of one's mind. As the song says, "The cross before me, the world behind me, no turning back, no turning back." Jesus says, you've got to lay something down, deny yourself. You've got to take something up, take up the cross. And He says, you've got to live something out. Don't read that as leave something out. That's what most of us do. It's live something out. He said in those two simple words, "Follow me. Follow me." You see, following Jesus is a way of life. It's not on again, off again. It's following Him into whatever and wherever He may lead, whether we understand it or not, whether we like it or not. Being a disciple and following Jesus means to follow and keep on following. It is a life to live. Now, obviously, living the life of a disciple of Jesus is not an easy task. It is not without its hard and difficult moments. It is a very rewarding life to live, and yet at times it can be dreadfully difficult. And sometimes it may even appear to be impossible, though it's not. There are many who have faltered along the way. There are some who have gotten into it without the understanding of everything that is involved. And if that's our case, there's no better time than right now to renew our zeal and to redouble our efforts in the matter of discipleship. And even though our lesson this morning takes its title from the parable of the Great Supper in Luke chapter 14, And specifically that invitation that was sent out in that parable, all things are ready, come to the feast. And while that parable in its initial application, as Jesus told it, applied to the Jews and their rejection of God's offer of salvation, the things that kept them from accepting the offer and the fact that the offer was then extended to everyone, I want us to look at that parable this morning, not as the Jews would have seen it, but as God's people need to see how important it is that we keep in mind the greatness of that invitation and the limitations that we place upon God's blessings by the excuses that we sometimes offer for not being better disciples than we are. Our lesson text is the 14th chapter of the book of Luke, and if you'd like to turn there with me, we're going to be reading some of the passages, some of the verses from that chapter in the course of our discussion. The events that we read about there take place on a Sabbath day when Jesus had been invited to a meal in the house of a prominent Pharisee. A rather interesting occasion in and of itself, as Jesus, the dreaded enemy of the Pharisees, was given a specific invitation to come. And from the wording of not just the text and explanation of the event, but also from what Jesus said, it appears that there were probably a lot of people there. And no doubt there were those there who were very much like that ruler of the Pharisees, very important people. And Luke tells us from the very outset that Jesus is under close scrutiny there in that gathering. And from the first few verses of this chapter, actually before we get to the parable of the Great Supper, I want to point out three things, three very important lessons about true discipleship. And first of all, I would suggest to you that true discipleship may indeed require of us that we redefine our notion of religion. It may be that we've got this all figured out, but that we've got it all figured out wrong. In verses 1 through 6, Luke says, "One Sabbath, when he went to dine at the house of the ruler of the Pharisees, they were watching him carefully. And behold, there was a man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, 'Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not?' But they remained silent. Then he took him and healed him and sent him away. And he said to them, 'Which of you, having a son or an ox that has fallen into a well on the Sabbath day, will not immediately pull him out?' And they could not reply to these things." Now, God's law in the Mosaic Covenant provided that a person was not allowed to work on the Sabbath day. But the Pharisees had felt that God's law really wasn't clear enough and didn't go far enough or was a little bit vague on this subject. So they decided they would help God out and define what work was on the Sabbath day. And they had come up with all kinds of rules and regulations that applied to this matter of working, or this prohibition of working on the Sabbath day. They taught that you couldn't wear a heavy coat if you went out on the Sabbath day, because in the event that you got too hot with that coat on and had to take it off, you would have to carry it, and that would constitute carrying a burden, which was work. And you couldn't do that on the Sabbath day. You could not, according to the Pharisees, tie a knot on the Sabbath day. You could not kill flies or even fleas, for that was work on the Sabbath day. And my personal favorite was that a woman was not allowed to look in a mirror, because she might see gray hair in her head and pluck it out and be guilty of reaping on the Sabbath day. These fellows had their religion all hemmed in and boxed up. They had it just like they wanted it. They had it all figured out. The problem was it didn't say the same thing that God said. Jesus was not very impressed with their work on God's law. In fact, of them, he said in Matthew 23, verse 4, they tie up heavy burdens and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are unwilling to move them with so much as a finger. And it's on this occasion that Luke says in verse 1 that these Pharisees were watching him carefully. The word watching there literally means interested and sinister espionage. In other words, they weren't just casually looking at him. They weren't just looking to see what he was wearing or where he was sitting. They were watching carefully to take note of what he did in order to find something wrong and hold it against him. You'll notice in verse 2 that Luke says, or in verse 3, Jesus responded to the lawyers and Pharisees. You know, I didn't hear them ask a question or even make a statement, did you? But Jesus did. You see, not only were they watching Jesus carefully, he was also watching them on the inside. He was seeing some things that they couldn't see about him. He was reading their hearts because Luke says he responded to them. He preempts them with a question for them about healing on the Sabbath. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath or not? Now, this was an age-old argument that they had with Jesus. In fact, Jesus had already healed at least 6 times on the Sabbath in the presence of the rulers of the Jews. And every time they got mad. And from the wording of Luke's account here, it seems that this fellow with the dropsy had been planted. And Jesus knew he'd been planted. In fact, Jesus saw through this whole ruse, and it says that he healed the man and then sent him on his way. That's pretty clear evidence that the man wasn't there because he was to enjoy the feast. He was there because he was part of the ploy. And then Jesus challenged them with a question that, again, they couldn't answer. You see, they had their own definition of religion. And it was not in keeping with God's definition of religion. In their definition of religion, barnyard animals were more important than suffering people. There is no doubt that some who call themselves disciples today have also got things a little bit turned around. And we need to examine or re-examine very carefully our definition of religion and our definition of what our relationship with God should be and make sure that we have the same definition that God does. The writer Calvin Miller, in an article in Christianity Today a few years back, notes that many Christians are only Christaholics and not really disciples at all. Disciples are cross-bearers. They seek Christ. Christaholics are only seeking happiness. Disciples dare to discipline themselves with the demands that are placed on them, and they fulfill those demands, and that leaves them enjoying the happiness of their growth. Christaholics are escapists looking for a shortcut to nirvana. There is no automatic joy, he says. Christ is not a happiness capsule. He is our way to the Father, but the way to the Father is not a carnival ride in which we sit and do nothing while we are whisked through various spiritual sensations. I don't think I've ever seen a man-written piece that sums up any better where some people who claim to be in the Lord's church really are. Number two, from this passage, we also learn that true discipleship places no premium on earthly honor and recognition. In verses 7 through 11, Jesus told them a parable. The word parable there is a little bit different word from what we normally find a parable. This could be translated, gave them this word, or gave them this teaching, or told them this. To those who were invited, when he noticed how they chose the places of honor, saying to them, when you're invited by someone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in a place of honor, lest someone more distinguished than you be invited by him, and he who invited you both will come and say, give your place to this person. Then you'll begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you're invited, go and sit in the lowest place, and then when your host comes, he may say to you, friend, move up higher. Then you'll be honored in the presence of all who sit at table with you. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Jesus looked around and he saw the people, and it was the custom of that day when people were invited to a banquet such as that. When the word was sent out, all things are ready, come to the feast, everybody rushed in, and there was a mad fight for the seats that were closest to the host. And occasionally someone would come in late who was an honored guest, and they would be taken to their place, and whoever was sitting in their place would be asked to move, and he'd have to go all the way to the end of the table, the end of the line. But the last phrase there in verse 11 is a summary of how we are to treat ourselves as disciples. We're to let the Lord do the exalting. But in everything, we all want to move up. We're geared to excel. In today's culture, we're trained to constantly reach up and claim the best for ourselves. That may be the way it has to work in the business world. But spiritually speaking, against the advice of the world and against even our human instincts, Jesus says that we should take for ourselves the lowest place. Not for the pure sake of self-punishment or self-abuse, but rather because that puts us in a position where we are most available for God's use. And He will position us from there accordingly. Now, some folks cannot understand that because they've never tried it. But I promise you it works. As James said in James 4, verse 10, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. Number three, Jesus teaches us here that true discipleship involves being more concerned for others than for me. In verses 12 through 14, He also said to the man who had invited Him, when you give a dinner or a banquet, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or your rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and you be repaid. But when you give a feast, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, the blind, and you'll be blessed because they cannot repay you. You will be repaid at the resurrection of the just. Religion in Jesus' day had become a complicated social system in which every little act on the part of some was done in view of what it would bring back to them in terms of payback and return favors, very much like some of us are familiar with in the workplace today. Men were exalted by other men just for the sake of future considerations. Their religion had grown into a disgusting system of do unto others so they will return the favor. The true disciple of today must be in possession of that genuine compassion of Christ, of which we studied last Sunday morning. We must be known as the kind of people who are concerned for others, regardless if they will ever be in a position to return the favor for us or not. Discipleship is more than just tossing a few dollars in the collection plate and hoping that the poor and the needy will get some good out of it. True discipleship is getting involved, getting your hands dirty, serving others, which is the service of the Lord. Paul said in Philippians 2, verses 3 and 4, "Do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interest, but also to the interest of others." And then we come to the parable. And for the sake of the lack of time, we're just going to notice this brief point. The blessings of true discipleship are limited not by the extent of God's invitation to come and serve, but the blessings of true discipleship are limited by our unwillingness to serve. The question is often asked, "What's in it for me?" When it comes to being a disciple of Jesus, there is much in it. But those who offer excuses and refuse to serve will never see the blessings. As we read at the beginning of the worship hour, these people who were invited to this banquet offered excuses. It's important that you understand how that kind of thing worked in those days. Far in advance of this banquet, invitations were sent out. And as is proper today, it was required that if you were coming to the banquet, you were to, as we say today, RSVP. Or respond to the invitation and let the host know when you would come. Now in that day and time, the invitation did not have the exact hour of the banquet. Rather, everyone who was invited was to be available, and then when everything was ready, the word was sent out, "All things are ready, come to the feast." Ladies, wouldn't that be neat if we did things like that today? There wouldn't be the pressure, "Oh, this has got to be ready by 6 o'clock. But that's the way it was in that day. And so all of these people had been invited, had been told days in advance about this banquet, and they'd said, "Yes, I'll be there. Count me in." And now it's ready. And the servants are sent out to tell the people to come in. And everyone offers excuses. And in the parable, Jesus tells of three excuses that are offered by the invited guests. And those three excuses represent the same kind of hindrances that we often come up against in our lives today as disciples of the Lord. There was, first of all, the purchase of a piece of property that needed to be looked at. The excuses that are about possessions and acquisitions. "Oh, yes, I'd do more for the church, but you know, I've got so much that I have to see after. You know, I've got this there and that over there, and we've acquired so much that requires so much attention. We're just often not available to be the Lord's disciples." The second man said, "I've purchased 5 yoke of oxen and they need to be tested." "Oh, I'm just so busy. My job requires that I be there instead. I'm sorry, I can't come. Earthly occupations are important, but they are not more important than being the Lord's disciple." And then the third man said, "Well, you know, I've recently gotten married. Just can't come."
You know, the Levitical law did forbid one who was newly married from going to war. There was no rule against going to a banquet. In fact, what new bride would ever think of turning down an invitation to go to a rich man's fancy banquet? Relationships. You know, I'd do more for the Lord, but that old husband of mine just holds me back. Or if I could get my wife on board here, I could be a better servant, but you know, it's just not going to work. Or, I know we're gone a lot, but we have to visit those kids. The summation of these attitudes represented in all of those excuses could be summed up in one word: desire. We will do what we desire to do. We will get what we desire to have. We will go where we desire to go. If we desire to do it, we'll figure out a way, won't we? Folks, this is not about going to banquets. This is about accepting the Lord's invitation. What kind of disciples are we? Are we servants of the Lord? Are we producers of excuses? Once again, the blessings of true discipleship are not limited by the range of God's invitation. The blessings are limited by our own reluctance to serve. If you're not a child of God this morning, why not do exactly what the New Testament teaches in order to be saved? Believe in Jesus as God's Son, repent of your sins, confess your faith in Him, and be baptized, and have those sins washed away. Doing so will make you a member of His body, a member of His kingdom. If you've done that but have become unfaithful in your life of service to Him, we hope and pray that you would use this opportunity to be restored.